We would like to thank you for attending session 238 titled Navigating Complex Relationships, Non-Monogamy and Marriage. Before we begin, we ask that all cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging in the question and answer portion of this session following the remarks of the presenter. Those who cannot abide by those guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. I have children. I will take you out. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine. Hey. Yeah. 7 issues for the price of 6 at the registration desk. Consider purchasing Skull Candy official headphones customized just for Sunstone. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. I was so hopeful. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask that both the audience and the presenter to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin preparation for the next session.
It was up.
That's better, right?
Bring them back.
Oh, no. No, you're not the problem.
No, that's okay. All right, I'm going to introduce it, and then I will see if I can get them to come back again. Okay. Many aspects of being in a non-monogamous, poly, or open relationship are actually similar to those in being in a monogamous relationship. There are also some notable differences. This presentation will cover a few of the unique challenges of non-monogamy and how to cope with them. Natasha Parker, LCMFTCST, is a certified sex therapist and a licensed marriage and family therapist. She currently serves as the president of the Mormon Mental Health Association and president of the Kansas Division of the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy.
All right,
thank you.
Okay. Well, a big part of life is flexibility, right? So when PowerPoints don't go as planned, we just kind of roll with the flow. So that's what I'll try to do. I just wanted to, first of all, thank you for being here on, I think, what can oftentimes be a taboo or controversial topic. So I'm always pleased when people show up to these kinds of presentations. I think that's great, whether you're interested in this type of lifestyle or not. But some disclosures I'd like to just throw out there from the get-go. I'm going to be presenting on a very complex topic in a very short amount of time. So this is really meant to be an overview of some of the information that might be useful around these issues. It is by no means all-inclusive. It will by no means probably touch on many of your experiences, and I'm not advertising it as such. The other disclosure is that I am not myself in a polyamorous or non-monogamous relationship. I'm really coming at this more from a clinical perspective, and so I am fully aware I have lots to learn, and you know, would love to hear feedback from maybe some of those of you who are navigating these types of waters. This is obviously not therapy, so you know, whatever that means. I just need to say that ethically, I guess. And also, this is not at all meant to address sexual trauma. So these are just some disclosures. I want to also just throw out there that if you're here with a partner, please don't use me as a club. I don't like to hear that, well, Natasha's up, so you really should, blah, 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 blah. So just, these are some ideas and some thoughts and concepts that may or may not apply to your relationship. And I don't know why I lost it, sorry. And also, I'm not here to try to convince people to enter into polyamorous relationships, and I'm not here to criticize polyamorous relationships. I'm just really here kind of as hopefully as much of a blank slate as possible without personal bias, which we all carry. Let's see. And I want to just start out with the idea that I believe that there are many legitimate paths to relational and personal health and success, and that those that want to engage in non-monogamous relationships have a right to do that. I don't think that those who want to are more progressive or those who don't want to are less progressive. I think this is really a lot more about personal taste, personal relationships, personal stories. So that's all the disclosures I could think of to hopefully make this go well. All right. Are you lucky yet? No? Okay. Shoot, my slides were really actually helpful to my presentation. All right, so I want to start off by just having a conversation that sexuality is defined for all of us in a variety of ways from a variety of organizations, peoples, cultures, family, etc. And we all come with that in whatever ways that may manifest. So a big piece of why we're here today is obviously religion plays a huge role in defining what healthy sexuality should look like. And we also have our family systems play a big role in defining what healthy sexuality should look like. And also I would say that the media plays a huge role in how healthy sexuality should look like. And when I say should, what I mean by that is that all of those entities really prescribe their own ideas about what that is defined to be, whether it's really backed up by experience or research or things of that nature is not necessarily always the case. So I'd like to cover some of those basic messages that I think we should at least be willing to think about or overcome or be willing to challenge or address in our own lives. So one message that we've gotten for a long time, especially in Western romanticized culture, is that long-term, one primary partner, heteronormative, Judeo-Christian relationships are like the best. Like, those are the way to go. And all other relationships are kind of subpar. And that those are, you know, really what we should all be striving for. And along with that, we very much get the message that sexual desire is scary and can often be a destructive force in our lives. So we come at sexual education and sexual ideas, and especially sexual ideas about health, from the perspective of, okay, well done. Now I don't know how to do this. Okay. Yes, I do. Is that correct? Oh, yeah, okay. Let me just show you. Okay, so this is only good relationship available. Oh, this is my disclosure slide. Religion, family, media. Okay, we're all caught up. So we hear a lot about out-of-control urges. We hear a lot about pornography and sexual addictions. We hear a lot about brain changes when it comes to our sexuality, et cetera, et cetera. So we're very scared about the potential risks about sex. And since we usually get most of our sexual education at times when most people don't want us to be sexual, so like 14, 15, et cetera, then this is kind of really heavily, you know, a part of what we're getting at. And especially with religion, we then get this kind of supernatural force involved, right, that wants to control us through our sexuality. We also have this message that romance and love and passion are necessary for good sex. And my marriage and family therapy training definitely pushed that as far as intimacy. My sex therapy training did not always coincide with my marriage and family therapy training, so that was an interesting dichotomies I had to deal with and learn how to make room for both. And so you know, so in other words, we delegitimize casual sexual encounters or encounters with people that maybe you don't have super big intimacy with yet. I see this a lot, this kind of message that if I love you and you love me, that really then I have a right to control your sexual behavior, and that your behavior, if it does not coincide with what I'm comfortable with, is not okay. And obviously those are discussions that we all need to have in our relationships, and sometimes relationships become unsustainable due to those kinds of concerns. However, when we're coming at it from this perspective of really, I kind of own your sexuality or you own mine, I'm not sure that's the healthiest place. And I think growing up, for those of us who grew up Mormon, we definitely got that idea that your sexuality is to be saved or awakened or used by a partner that I may or may not know yet, but it still belongs to them. It doesn't belong to me. And then I get to decide how I want to share it. So that becomes kind of a breeding ground for a lot of insecurity in our relationships. In other words, I should be the only object of your desire. And if I'm not, then that's a threat to our relationship and to our intimacy. And we don't necessarily do this with other things. In other words, if you don't like, you know, books, but I do, I go to the book club, and that's not a threat to our relationship. But when it comes to sexuality, it's quite different for most people. We also definitely get the message that jealousy is inevitable and that there's really no overcoming it, and that that's just a natural feeling that all of us should feel, especially if our sexual interest is interested in something other than ourselves. So I think one of the big first tasks of kind of getting past some of these messages is kind of just speaking with ourselves or kind of contemplating with ourselves or our partners, how do we want to define sexuality, healthy sexuality? What kinds of things do we want to put on our list? And I'm not going to go through all of these just due to time, but I think that this is a somewhat comprehensive list. You don't have to have all of these things on your list, but I think the first one should be kind of on everybody's list. After that, it's kind of up to you what you want to put on your list or not. But these are things that it really doesn't matter. I mean, I think it's interesting how we tend to, especially in Mormon culture, see married sex as healthy. And I see a lot of married people not having healthy sexual values or concepts or ethics in their relationship. And we really don't make space for anything other than the way we've set up sexuality in Mormonism, that there could be healthy relationships outside of marriage or traditional marriage that could include very much some of these concepts. So again, it's just kind of sitting with that discomfort and being willing to open up to different possibilities about how we're going to look at these very important relationships that we have in our life. So how are we going to define monogamy? And this is really interesting. You know, I think that people think that, you know, kind of like when you say, oh, I'm Mormon, oh, me too, and we just assume a lot that we think about each other. But it's interesting to me how people will define monogamy in different ways. So is it monogamous to have one partner watching pornography? Is it monogamous to have one partner masturbating without the other partner either knowing about it or being included in it? Is it monogamous to have sexual thoughts or fantasies that don't include your partner? Is it monogamous to sext with somebody that isn't your partner, but you're not having any physical relationship with? So it gets a little complicated, and most of us have not really been taught how to sexually contract with our partners, where we're really able to explore these types of questions without a lot of moral overlay that kind of stops conversations. And a book I really recommend, even though it's really more about infidelity, but I think it just has a lot of really good questions in it, is The New Monogamy by Tammy Nelson, because she really kind of goes through this process of teaching people how to ask these difficult questions. So Do I have a right to privacy? Like, honesty is a really big principle in Mormon culture. And I think we believe that honest, we kind of conflate the two. So I can't have anything be private because that means I'm not honest. So how do we negotiate that in our relationships? Flirtation, sensuality, energy, are those part of, you know, what we're presenting as? And then this idea that somehow if you don't remain in a traditional monogamous relationship, that somehow you've lost your values, ethics, and morals, when, like the previous slide showed, that's really not the case at all. Okay, so as I work with a lot of transitioning Mormons in particular, this oftentimes comes up as an option that wants to be explored. And, or I hear a lot of stories about it happening kind of in our post-Mormon or transitioning Mormon communities. And so why are people interested in this? And I'm just gonna give you four reasons that I've come up with, but again, that are not all inclusive. So one is I wanna have new experiences. I want to explore new things. I want our marriage because I like you and we seem to have a good thing going, but I don't necessarily want to stop having experiences with other people either. So that's a very common, even non-Mormon reason why people start looking at polyamory as an option. The biggest one that I see is some form of regret. So I missed out on some opportunities by growing up in Mormon land. I got married when I was 19. I've only had one sexual partner my whole life. I got married in 3 weeks' time. I didn't even kiss the person beforehand, so we didn't know if there was sexual compatibility. We just assumed that would happen. That's a lot of stuff to be dealing with. It's a very normal thing to be dealing with as a faith transition process, and so that feeling of regret or that I missed out is very common. And the only things I'll say about that is that it's often not completely accurate. So when we rewrite our history, we tend to do that in a non-accurate way. So for example, I see a lot of non-Mormons who have regrets on the other side, like, I had too many sexual partners, I don't know why I did that, I wish I would have been more intimate with my partners versus having more casual sex. You know, so there's regrets kind of on all sides of fences, and that's just normal. And you know, the Mormon fence is one fence that we just have to deal with. I think a lot of people consider opening up their relationships if they're in a bisexual or mixed orientation marriage, which actually I think is a very healthy thing to consider if you're in that position, because a lot of people in those positions obviously were pressured to marry heterosexually, and that causes its own kind of issues. So I've seen that go very well for people. And then another reason is differences in sexual interests or libido. And so if you have one partner who wants to have sex maybe once a year, and you have one partner who wants to have sex once a week, like, that's a pretty diverse libido range, you know, versus like maybe two times a week versus five times a week. You know, that's a more doable libido range. Or I really would like to try a certain type of sexual experience and the partner really has no interest in that. So there's all kinds of reasons, but these are just kind of some of the ones I see a lot. And one thing I forgot to say in my first slide was, how am I defining non-monogamy? So I'm defining, this whole presentation is about relationships that are not pressured by a religion or a culture or politics. So nobody's feeling forced into these types of relationships. So I'm not talking about traditional polygamy where at 14 you're just expected to, you know, marry whoever your parents decide you're going to marry. I don't think I needed to say that, but just in case. I think there's benefits and risks to opening up relationships, just like there's benefits and risks to any activity you might do, including a monogamous marriage. So There might be unintended consequences, things you couldn't foresee or plan for. There might be, obviously, risks like heartbreak or STIs or pregnancy, just like we all learned all those risks when we were 14 or 15, right? There might be time management issues. Many people are like, I can barely make time for my one partner. How am I going to make time for another partner? Or, the partner, there's always more excitement kind of with a new partner. That's just what your brain does for about 18 months. And so your more stable partner might feel like, well, you seem to be making a lot of time for this partner that you don't normally make for me. So those kinds of issues. Heartbreak. Discrimination is a real thing. This type of community is usually not very open about their lifestyle because there's a lot of legal implications and custody implications and all kinds of stuff. And you might have an uneven experience. So like one of you is all of a sudden having three sexual partners and the other one's like, I thought I was going to, but nobody seems to want me. You know, so that might be a sad thing to have to negotiate. And so anyway, those are some of the risks. And then benefits are, we might be going on an adventure together we never anticipated. There's something maybe fun or exciting about that. There's an opportunity for a different awareness relationally and individually. There's potential for pleasure. And there's problem solving for certain issues, like I mentioned in the previous slide. I think also on the risks, what you need to understand too is that you and your partner may have a very good understanding of what you want, but that doesn't always translate to now new parties. So in other words, they may have different ideas or initial negotiations go awry. So for example, we're only interested in swinging, for example, we're gonna keep it very casual, but then that third party falls in love or wants something deeper. That's, again, unintended things that just come up because relationships are complicated, people are complicated, so you can't always plan everything in advance the way you'd want. So mistakes or regrets I often see when people try this type of a lifestyle, things that maybe I would recommend avoiding, is the pendulum shift. We tend to take our Mormon DNA with us no matter where we go. And so we can be very rigid over here, but then be extremely rigid on this side of the pendulum as well. We can be very black and white over here, and we can do that over here. So maybe different ideas or different concepts, but kind of similar process. And so I would just really encourage you to understand the mistakes are going to be made and expect hiccups and be a little bit flexible, especially if you're rejecting your value systems that you came from, and so then you're going to swing the other way, and so, well, I'm not going to listen to any of the values that I learned in Mormonism, and so I'm going to just, you know, be very reactive in my angry phase of transitioning. Probably not. Anger time of transitioning is very normal and very healthy, but not the best time to make like life-altering decisions. A big mistake is just miscommunication. I thought you wanted this. Oh, I thought you wanted this. I mean, a classic one I have is a couple where he thought he was talking about fantasy and she thought he was talking about reality. And so she went and did what she thought he wanted her to do. And big problems came from that. She didn't even want to do it. She just was like, but I thought you wanted me to. I thought that would turn you on. Okay. Wrong reasons. So if you think that this is going to be the solution for an already toxic or dysfunctional marriage, it's probably not going to be. I talked to a woman who, because I was asking her advice about a Sunstone article I'm writing about non-monogamy, and she's kind of one of the leading people in our field about it, and she's like, it was interesting that she used this language because she's not Mormon at all, but she's like, many, many are called, few are chosen. I was like, interesting. So it can sound really great or really exciting, and then you realize it's just really maybe not your cup of tea. And I think, again, the speed of your decision is a regret. So I hear of a lot of stories, for example, where we went to the, and these stories are not meant to shame anybody. Like, I think these are all really normal stories. So if I'm happening to talk about your situation, I totally understand why this might have happened. You're at the first post-Mormon retreat you've ever been at. Everybody's in the hot tub. You're so excited, and you're feeling super intimate with everybody. And all of a sudden, you know, you're kissing somebody else, and your spouse is kissing somebody else, and you're like, well, that's exciting in the moment. And then the next morning's like, what the hell happened? And now we're at the PTA meeting together, and I don't know what to do, right? So that's pretty common, because you get caught up in that mode and that transition time, which is already very raw. And I see a lot of communities, post-Mormon communities, really struggling with some of those things that happen. And I think we just need to have grace for each other, because it's I think part of that developmental stage that we're going through in faith transitioning. So there's different types of non-monogamy. There's people who kind of know from the get-go, I never want to really be, you know, fully tied to one person. I'm not interested in being married. These people don't really fit well in our Mormon culture. I don't know why. And so, you know, they're not interested in it. So their plan is to have ongoing relationships and explore different types of things with different people. You have kind of the classic word, which is swinging, or casual non-monogamy, which is, I'm very much tied to my principal partner. I'm really not looking for emotional connection other than maybe a friendship with other people. We want to have some excitement to our sexuality. We think involving other people might add to that. But I'm not interested in having anything further with the third party. And that can happen together or alone. So in other words, we're going to do that together. We're going to go out together and have fun that way. Or we're going to do that separately. Then you've got your ones where there are more connections, there's more lifestyle involvement with other partners, but there's still like the primary relationship, so me and my original husband, that I'm in love or have an ongoing relationship with one person, and maybe he does too, but we're still the primary people. We live together, we make financial decisions together. We're probably not doing that with secondary or tertiary partners, but they might be more involved in our lives. They might meet some of our family. They might meet some of our friends. There's more involvement. There's more long-term emotional connection. And then there's full-blown polyamory, which all my terms, by the way, are probably really sucky, so I'm totally open to being taught better terms. But this is where really we're going to merge family systems. We are going to parent each other's children. We're going to make financial decisions together. We're going to maybe possibly live in the same residences or near each other and make lifelong decisions with more than one person. Okay? Again, I'm not going to go through all of these individually, but I think these are good things to keep in mind. Is that the last one? Things that you wouldn't, again, when you're in the hot tub and making that decision in those 2 minutes, you probably have not discussed a lot of these things with your partner. And they're really important. They make a huge difference as far as feeling secure, feeling open, feeling like we're on the same page. It is very common that one partner is much more interested in opening up a relationship than the other. So it's a very common thing. So how do we make space for that and for the discussion of what type of openness we want or even want to explore? Just because we're talking about it doesn't mean we have to do it, right? So, but these are some things if you're going to take the next step. You know, what type are we going to use? Condoms, birth control? Is there certain types of sex that I'm okay with you having and certain types of sex I don't want you having? Do we tell each other about our experiences if we're doing something individually, or would I rather not know? Just want to know kind of very generalities. Who's off limits? I've had a lot of problems with that. Like, I didn't realize you were going to go after my best friend. Like, that was not what I thought was going to be okay, or my sister. I've had that as well. So, which some people might be okay about, right? We all went, ew, which is okay to have that reaction. Some people are okay with that, but you have to talk about it, right? You have to talk about it. Do wedding rings come off or stay on? So in other words, do I present myself as a married individual or not? If we're kind of doing the classic bar pickup scene, what do we do with kids? Do we tell the kids? Do we tell family members or not? These are all just kind of some of the recommendations that maybe I would have you think about. And you can see the complexity. And I would say, we're not doing, like, diddly squat in this in monogamous relationships. So that's why I'm saying, like, maybe start more so with your primary relationship and then get better at those kinds of contractual communications and then move forward from there. So recommendations. Again, just time yourself. There's no need to make rash decisions. I think most of the couples that I've worked with that really do negotiate this very successfully spend almost 6 months to a year with me prior to even doing anything. I mean, just to tell you kind of the timelines involved. There's no need to make any quick decisions. There's no, like, polyamory crisis, right? So I really like taking an exploratory approach. In other words, you can say, you know what, I'm willing to try that, but I really can't anticipate how I'm going to feel about that yet. And so it's okay to back up or come back to the drawing table and say, you know, after trying that for 3 months or something, it's not really working in the way I thought it would, so that nobody has to feel trapped or, well, like I already said I would, so now I have to, or things of that nature. Communication. I really think, especially if we're coming from our culture, that professional help is almost like, I don't want to say mandatory because I hate using that word, but this is tough stuff to negotiate, even if you don't come from like a rigid, enmeshed religious culture like ours. So I just think having some, but it's also very important to find somebody who's sex positive, because a lot of therapists will go back to that, but this is going to affect your intimacy, or, you know, they're going to shame maybe this exploration or not be supportive of this type of exploration. Find support groups. There's a lot of great ones that have good boundaries. Get legal support if needed. And there's some books that I would recommend as far as, the Ethical Slut, right? Like, a lot of Mormons are going to read that. But it has really good information. I'm constantly telling my colleagues, I know those kind of things sell, but they really don't help the majority of the people who won't even purchase them, you know? So anyway, but those are some good notes. Is that? Okay. So that, I wanted to kind of go through this somewhat quickly because I really wanted to open, you know, leave some time for questions. I still can't find out. This is different than my computer. And that's not the slide I want. Although I do love, that's a whole other presentation, is old people having sex. And I don't mean that derogatory. Like, you should be having the best sex of your life in your 60s and 70s, so that's my hope. That I'll do that next year. All right, I'll keep it, I guess, with the recommendations page. All right, did you want to say something before we start with questions?
No, I was just going to say, if you maybe want to use that microphone there, and then I can...
Okay.
Sorry. That's okay. Does anybody... I think that they want us to record questions, so yep. Does anybody want to come up and ask some
I'll
questions,
take the
or
microphone.
She'll take it
yeah,
around?
If you want.
Okay. Ooh, I'm stuck. Okay, I'll sit down.
Okay.
There we go. We know what we're doing around here now, I promise.
Sorry.
Okay. So I just wondered, other than polygamy, which I heard about mostly, of course, in the historical context, having grown up LDS. I had not really run across any mention of polyamory or anything like that. until I started reading romance when I was in early college, and then I started running across it every now and then, and I find it actually very interesting stories because it's more complex and so it's a lot more interesting to read. But I was wondering, is it becoming more acknowledged, more mainstream, and is there a way to make it become maybe more accepted, maybe never, you know, maybe like the primary relationship, but just something where people will accept it and not, you know, we won't have, you know, the problems with people looking down at people who have non-traditional relationships.
Yeah, hopefully that's already happening. The research that I...
Wait, some of my mic
here.
Is working.
We'll just turn that one off. I'll just bring this back.
I'm sorry. Is it working? Okay. Maybe I just have to kiss it. I'm having a non-monogamous relationship with my microphone.
I'm glad that's recorded.
Yes, I'm so sorry. Anyway, so the last conference that we went to, which was just a few months ago in Puerto Rico, the best stats that we have, again, a lot of people will not report that they're in these types of relationships because of the stigma attached, even in anonymous surveys, which is true really for all sexual data. And however, we're looking at probably about 3% of the population admitting to having some type of non-monogamous relationship in the United States. Now in Europe, they're coming up with numbers closer to 20% with people under the age of like 30.
So my analytical brain noticed that on your risk page, you don't have any statistics. And I'm curious about, from the perspective of somebody who wants to maintain their marriage, what are the statistics of success or failure of a marriage that enters into this? It seems to me, at least my perception, and maybe this is framed by my Mormon framework, but this seems like incredibly risky. I mean, like, are we talking 1% of marriages that successfully navigate this space? 10%? What is the percentage from analysis, or do you have that kind of statistic?
I don't have that kind of, I haven't been able to find statistics on that. If anybody has a different answer to that, I'll be open to that. Now, anecdotally, like, so through my practice, I would say only about 1-3% of my couples even bring this up as something that they'd want to try. And every single one of my couples has done a really great job with that. But that's not a lot of people when you look at just one practitioner. So I know there's a lot of people out there who are divorcing and having huge marital strife after these types of I guess, experimentations. When I hear those stories, I often don't hear, "Oh, but we were in there. We were with a sex positive therapist who was helping us navigate that." I usually hear more of the stories of either they were a pretty dysfunctional marriage to begin with, or they went too fast, or there were unintended consequences that they didn't prepare for or contract for. So I'm not really in the mood to blame polyamory. I'm more in the mood to blame our ability to communicate and prepare for such a decision to begin with. Mood has nothing to do with research, though. So if any of you are researchers, this would be great. Especially in the Mormon community, I think this would be fascinating research to do.
I'm wondering if one of the partners isn't on the bus, should you just abandon the idea? Or do you see people being talked into it? Sounds harsh, but you know what I mean. Should both partners be on the bus from the get-go?
So this is where my conversation on discomfort comes in. I think that discomfort is a natural process to any change. And thank you. And so, but we come from a culture where discomfort means the devil's out to get ya. And so I think that having a scale would be good. So if I'm at like a level 9 out of 10 discomfort, probably not a really great idea. But if I'm at like a level 3 or 4, can I push through some of that discomfort for an exploratory amount of time? to see whether or not this is going to be something that could fit into our relationship. I'm also a big believer in starting out very minimally. So fantasy is a great place to start a non-monogamous relationship. So we usually have a lot of fantasy that we've never talked about, like orgies, or I'm going to meet up with somebody and have sex with them on the first night, or those are just kind of like cultural fantasies that a lot of us have never divulged, because that's scary. That would mean we actually have to be intimate and show up, and we're not taught how to do that. And so it can be really, I mean, a lot of my people just kind of, not the 1% to 3%, but the others who come up with the regrets and things, they do fun things like put on wigs and put on hoochie mama dresses and head out to the bars, and they get picked up by their husbands and like go have hot sex in a crummy hotel. And like that's really fun, right, to live out those kinds of fantasies, things that they never really allowed their partner to know that was a fantasy. So I think that's a good place to start. Then maybe move on to erotica or pornography or things of that nature and see, you know, what, how do I feel when I see maybe a threesome on an erotic film, and let's think about that. And so again, there's phases to how we deal with the discomfort. But it's also, like I say, there's no shame in saying this isn't for me. And that doesn't mean that I'm broken or frigid or that there's something, you know, because sometimes we have this tendency to, the more open you are to exploring, the more mature you must be. And then that's just not true. We all have our different sexual tastes, erotic templates, and I love the don't yuck my yum and don't yum my yuck. You know, in other words, I don't have to be disgusted that something turns you on, or if I am, I can watch that and be accepting of that, but don't force me to like something that I don't like.
I'm part of a post-Mormon community out of state, and just to ask, or kind of maybe have something to answer this guy's question in the front row, a lot of the couples there who've been through faith transitions end up going, seem to me, to have gone, kind of go down the polyamory or open marriage route to try in a last-ditch effort to save their marriage, because it seems like once Mormonism gets out of the way, people kind of see that there's not really a reason to be together anymore because they're not compatible. And I, as a newly single woman in that community, I seem to get invited a lot into these threesomes and whatever, and I've never participated and I never will, and I make it clear that that's not how I roll. But it seems like most of them, there's only one couple I'm aware of that's part of that community that hasn't gotten divorced. All the other couples have been divorced now. And this couple has very clear, open communication. They have very strict rules. They communicate a lot, they invite their partners over and they meet each other and they do things together and activities even with their kids around, the other partners there. And anyway, so they seem to be making it work for now at least, but it's just really interesting to me. And there's just kind of this weird phenomenon in the area that I live in where couples, most of them, once they leave the church, seem to go down that route of exploration. And it's fascinating to watch.
I'm not, I mean, we come from a polygamous past anyway, and so tell me that that hasn't crossed your mind, right? And so for all of us, I mean, I remember in my more believing days, I would think about what would it actually really be like to share my husband sexually. I mean, I was, in a sense, forced to think that because of our culture and our doctrine. So are we surprised that that's part of our erotic template often, you know, and as we faith transition, then how does that translate into our lived experience? I think that's actually very normal. The whole compatibility thing is something I struggle with, because again, I think most people decide they're incompatible during a faith transition, which I don't think is a good time to decide that. There are 5 million subconscious reasons why you attracted the partner you did, even if it wasn't 3 weeks. And I think that that's a very easy out. Not that I'm trying to, again, shame, like, oh, I'm out, it's so easy, I don't think anything about this is easy, but I'm just saying it's an easy way to think about it. Oh, this is why we must be having these marital struggles, is because we got married too young, or we weren't sexually compatible, or there's all kinds of, I mean, people have hot sex before marriage and don't have hot sex in their 40s, you know? So
this idea that somehow we would have known that we were sexually compatible if we would have had sex before marriage is just not accurate. If you're going to be with a long-term partner, there's going to be a journey with lots of ups and downs as far as the roller coaster is concerned. And anyway, so I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but I think it goes back to why are we seeing so much divorce. I think that's a very volatile time. I think faith transitions are brutal in our community. They're brutal. If you're Unitarian or Episcopal, like the more liberal Episcopalian, it's just, it's not that big of a deal. But if you're like some of the Adventist, Mormon, Jehovah's Witness, it's brutal. And if you're fundamentalist, well, you might just get killed for it. So we're only one step removed from the fundamentalist religion as far as the concept of Mormon. I thought we'd be conservative, and I forget there's conservative, there's something else, and then there's fundamental, and we're that something else that I can't remember. So that's why I was talking about the pendulum shifts. And that's when I think a lot of people, unfortunately, lose their marriages. Not that all marriages should survive, and sometimes faith transitions and opening up your relationship kind of gives you more ability to really negotiate that and say, you know what, maybe this is a good time for us to part ways. So I'm not saying it's all bad to divorce, but I'm just saying I think sometimes we're correlating reasons to that that aren't always maybe truly causal.
As you've gone through the presentation, one of the reoccurring topics is communication. And you want to continue to elaborate on that?
Yeah.
In all aspects of non-monogamy, from fantasy and so forth.
So, yeah, communication. It's a big word. I guess where I could just, for a short comment, send you to is Gottman's work and the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. I don't know if you've all heard about that or not. The Four Emotional Horsemen of the Apocalypse, which he covers. And he's one of the leading marriage and family therapists in our country and really has actually tied science to marriage therapy, which is really neat because it's hard to do with couples. But he has his love lab, and you get to go live in his apartment for 3 days, and he actually puts electrodes on you, and they measure all kinds of stuff. It's amazing. So what he's found out is that people who struggle with communication struggle with these four things. And one is criticism, which is kind of the example of, instead of, why didn't you take out the trash? I wish you would have. It's like, you lazy bastard, you didn't take out the trash, right? So that's the difference between a complaint and criticism. The second one is defensiveness, like, well, you didn't take out the trash last time, you know, instead of saying, you're right, honey, I am a lazy bastard, and I didn't take out the trash, I'm so sorry, right? So we usually don't have that response to criticism, we usually get defensive. And then the third one is contempt. So now it's like, I'm obviously so much smarter and better and more mature than you, and I don't even know how I ended up with you to begin with. That's contempt. And fourth is stonewalling, which is really like, I'm so flooded by you and I'm so like overwhelmed by you that I'm just checking out. So those four things ruin communication, and I think the base of that is often our own anxiety, our own fears, our own unmet desires, hopes, and wants, and our inability to create a safe space for one another. And what I mean by that, I don't mean that you just have to be like this every time I say something, because that's not very realistic. So it's kind of this double, it's two-sided coin where I need to be able to present safety to you. I need to be able to present something and have it be somewhat safe, but I also need it to be safe to have a reaction to you. And how do we really navigate that on an ongoing circular basis? That's my 2 minutes be along communication. Sorry, it's not better.
So this was kind of touched on earlier about if you have friends that are into swinging and you're not, but you respect that and everything else. I'm wondering if you have any advice on how to let people know that you're good with them and you're maybe even flattered, but that's not your thing, and still you can be friends and not have it be awkward. If you have any thoughts on that.
You mean you're having problems with boundaries in post-Mormon communities? just like we have problems with boundaries in LDS believing communities. Yeah, so we're not super, we don't come from a great boundaried culture, and that, you know, we don't automatically get good at boundaries just because we've transitioned from or in between the transition from Mormonism. So I think good, clear communication and exactly what you just said is all you can do. Now, whether or not they'll respond, you know, correct to that type of communication is, you know, it's kind of out of your control. So understanding what is in my control, what is not in my control, when do boundaries have to be firmer because people aren't kind of getting the message and they're becoming toxic. But an unfortunate maybe pattern that I've seen, again, where we take that LDS DNA with us, is that we can still be pretty judgmental. And so it's kind of that idea, well, like I've heard of, for example, people going to post-Mormon communities and they're still wearing their garments and being shamed for that, like, or being kind of like minimized, like, oh yeah, yeah, you're in that stage, right? But you'll get to where I'm at, you know, just assuming that garments will come off for those people. And I think we do that not with malintent, but we forget that everybody's going to have a different journey, and can we really open up ourselves to this idea that other people's journeys are just as valid as ours? And that's a hard thing to do, I think, no matter what culture you come from. I think we have 3 minutes if my watch is right. Yes.
I was curious to hear your thoughts about the relationship between physical intimacy and emotional intimacy in monogamous and non-monogamous relationships. I feel like, personally, I was raised to think that they're very, very closely coupled, and so it's difficult to see one without thinking the other is likely or is going on or something like that. And so I'm curious what that would look like in kind of monogamous compared to non-monogamous, and maybe just in general.
I'm so glad you asked that. That's one of my favorite questions. I need to add slides on this question. So if any of you are not familiar with Esther Perel's work, I highly recommend you Google her. She's got some great TED Talks. And she kind of talks about this idea that we all pretty much want two things in our relationship. One is stability, and one is novelty. So I want to know that the bills are going to be paid. I want to know that you're here to raise kids with me. I want to know that I can count on you. I want my best friend. But you know what? Best friends are not super hot and sexy. Right? And so I see a lot of really dysfunctional couples, really toxic, even domestic violence couples, having really hot sex. And I see really partnered friendship type, you know, relationships where they're very emotionally intimate and very low libido between them. So that's a conundrum, you know, and there's lots of conundrums in life and in relationships. So how can we, you know, increase the ability to have both stability and novelty in our relationships? And I think that just, we get creative, we go to work, we figure things out, and that's why also, too, it's very seductive to buy into the new relationship. Because again, our brains, we know this now, it's like the first time you chemically connect with somebody in an erotic way, that is intense hormonal stuff going on in your brain. And it lasts for about 18 months, and it never comes back. Never. So, yeah, new partners are hot, right? And excite us in ways that we're not used to maybe feeling or have forgotten how we felt. But we also know that the memory of that is what makes long-term relationships very sustainable, and the reason why I can still get goosebumps and butterflies in my tummy when I don't know, my husband smiles at me in a certain way. So that's, yeah, it's a great question, and it's not just because our emotional intimacy rises that our erotic intimacy will rise necessarily. And that's what I learned as a sex therapist versus a marriage therapist. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
You're talking post-Mormon couples, groups here. I've never been approached personally, but I know some people close to me that have, even in church. And
that's a great pickup place.
Yeah, and you know, rumor tells me that I, you know, I feel very, very naive sometimes, but that there's a lot of swinging going on in Provo, for example. And I was just wondering, you know, do you have any feel for how big this is actually within the church, and how do they justify that? It's just interesting to me.
Well, I don't statistically have a feel for it, but I have had clients who come to me and also have talked to various colleagues. And I don't know how many of you went to BYU, but I remember like hearing these stories when I was at BYU of people who would elope to Vegas, have sex for the weekend, and then annul it. And that was, you know, we had married sex. So, you know, that's great. And I was like, that's really confusing to me. Of course, I was a convert, came from a convert family, so I was like, is this really a thing? You know, like, I was always like, is this really a thing or not a thing? Like, anyway. So I see this a lot in married couples, too. So it's kind of like, well, how can we swing in a way that we can still answer the law of chastity question in our temple recommend interview? And people get pretty creative with that. So it's like, you can only do anything from here to here. You know, there's no genital contact or... I don't know, there's a lot of variety. So, I mean, Mormons are creative people. They're hard workers, they're efficient, so they find a way. Anyway, so, but here's my concern. It's kind of like when I have, and I can't tell you how many adolescents I have who come to me and are like, I'm a virgin, I'm so proud of that, you know, but yeah, I'm having anal sex and I'm having oral sex, and so no, like, ability to integrate their sexuality with themselves. It's like vagina, penis, that's how we're going to define it, and which hole they go into, and that will equate to what I can tell a bishop. So I don't care if all you want to do is kiss other people and that's how you've negotiated your swinging contract with your spouse, but I want it to come from an authentic ownership space, not I think we're just checking off the boxes so that I can still get my temple recommend. I think that's a very an unintegrated way to deal with your sexuality. And I think it's great for people to have oral sex before they're married. That's a great way to be sexual if you like it, but not because that keeps you a virgin. Does that make sense? So I think we're out of time.
We are.
I can talk sex all day.
I'm sure you can in the hallway.
All night long.
So you're welcome to do that. I don't know how Sunstone feels about that, but I'm all right with it. It's cool. So we'd like to thank you and
thank you so much
for being here. If you do have questions.